to the parking lot, parked it, zipped up my parka, joined the procession of marchers.
Welcome to the New York Times Podcast, your sparkling thrift shop find of music news and criticism. I am your host, John Caramonica.
What do I say? I want to take a stance because we are not free. And then I thought about it, we are not we. Am I on the outside looking in? Or am I on the inside looking out? Is it my place to get my two cents? Or should I stand on the side and shut my mouth? No justice, no peace. Okay, I'm saying that. They're chanting out Black Lives Matter, but I don't say it back.
You just heard a little bit of White Privilege 2 by Macklemore and Ryan Lewis. Here to talk about White Privilege 2, White Privilege and Whiteness, it's Macklemore.
What's up, man?
Welcome to the New York Times podcast.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
The people may not know, we've spent much of the day so far talking about a variety of subjects on this podcast, which we usually try to devote to conversational topics. We don't always have artists and superstars on the podcast, but we try to keep it conversational and very idea-driven. And the thing that we spoke about is trying to narrow down part of the conversation about this particular subject for this particular medium. I want to talk a little bit about the motivations behind that song, but let's start with the response to that song.
Sure.
Because as we were touching on earlier in the day, one of the things about sort of the instant feedback cycle is you get all these pieces, all these contrarian thoughts
right
off the rip. How prepared were you for that? And even if you were super prepared for that, how striking was it to kind of be on the receiving end of?
Yeah. I don't think that you can ever be fully prepared for it. You can hypothetically know that this is going to be polarizing or that this is going to get critiqued from all different angles, as it should. And you can say as it should, but it's different when the think pieces start trickling in or when like a song that you've been working on for the past year and a half immediately gets approval or dismissal within the first like 10 minutes that it's out via Twitter. So it was interesting to watch the feedback unfold. And it was, as most things that you put out into the universe, like watching them take life on the internet and this baby of a song that you've been that you've been creating for X amount of time leaves the nest and goes out into the world and becomes something that's dissected and analyzed and questioned and critiqued and loved and praised and everything in between. It's an interesting moment, and there's ups and downs with it. There's moments that feel really good, and there's moments that suck.
Are you able at all, as a creative, to let go of your, not let go of your attachment to the subject matter, but to understand that you've done the part that you can control?
Absolutely. It's a constant reminder, for one, that although this is our song meaning me and Ryan and everyone that contributed to it, that this is a song. And it's meant to start a conversation. It's meant to be critiqued. It's meant to have contradictions. It's meant to operate under the inherent flawed system in which it critiques. That's the only way that this song can exist. So you can hypothetically predict, you can feel like this could go one of many different ways, but until it's actually out there, it does feel differently. So you have to distance yourself at a certain point and realize that this isn't about you.
Right.
And that's the thing that you have to keep coming back to.
Do you get wounded at all?
In moments.
Yeah.
In moments, for sure. But that's okay. It's how you react to that wound. And if you're going to let that wound like sit you down, or if you're going to feel that and then get back up and keep pressing. And that's where I want to be accountable, is that regardless of the critique, regardless of who says what, regardless of the think pieces, that my commitment to an issue of race in America right now, of utilizing my platform, shining a spotlight on people that are doing the work in the movement that made this song possible in the first place, to continue to talk to my white audience about police brutality and white supremacy and privilege, that continues, regardless of whether or not the song is critiqued in the way that I wanted it to be.
Do you feel that critiques of the song that are aesthetically driven are differently valued than critiques of the song that are politically driven?
Of course.
Which do you feel like maybe speak to you more loudly? Because a thing that I read that you, I guess it was in an interview, maybe the NPR interview, I'm not sure. You did an interview where you talked about this song almost being thought of as a play.
Yes.
Or you didn't want to put it in the framework of 3 minutes and 30 seconds,
absolutely
4 minutes and
not
20 seconds.
No.
What does that mean, though? Because ultimately, you're a pop musician, you're a rapper. Like, this is the space that you operate in. but you chose deliberately to elide the center of that space to talk about this subject. Why choose that?
Well, for one, I don't think that talking about white supremacy or privilege or police brutality or cultural appropriation can be condensed into 9 minutes, much less 3 minutes. I think that either way, you're touching on like the very surface of it. There was no attempt in that. I wanted to do something that was a play. I wanted to make a piece of audio that operated in vignettes. And each song is different. Each song has a different intention. There was no point in even the songs that turned into popular music that I was like, we're making pop music now. Sure. Like, this is the format. Of course, we operate under those confines.
And you're raised by, I mean, you know.
Right. Yeah. We're conditioned to have a 16-bar verse and an 8-bar chorus and a 16-bar verse and a bridge and whatever. Right. That's popular music. That's modern-day music. Mm-hmm. But how can we push that? Not as pop artists, but as artists. How can we push those norms? And this was the type of record that I felt I wanted to create a visual in terms of the audio and a play-like atmosphere.
Something that the song, and I don't know if this was a deliberate reference or trigger for you, the middle section of the song where I guess it's the mother or the grandmother saying, like, you're the only rap I let my child listen to, or it's so that maybe that 30-second window reminded me a lot of Stan, the Eminem record. Mm. And I thought a lot about that as like a narrative play piece, but still works in an effective 4 minute and some odd framework. Mm-hmm. And then you think of political rap songs like, you know, By the Time I Get to Arizona or F the Police or whatever, which are extremely obviously, or The Message, which we talked about earlier, which are obviously message driven songs, but still work within that framework. Talk to me about the different effectiveness, because I think you can make an argument that those songs are particularly effective because they deliver a message within that.
But there's a hook there.
Right.
I mean, Stan's interesting because Stan is four verses.
Right. It's not a standard 320. It's longer.
No one does four verses.
Right.
The Message is a hella long song.
That's true.
I would say that that's like probably close to a 6-minute record if I was just guessing.
For those of you who have never heard The Message.
You know, I think the difference is that there was no hook on this song.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a chance. There's Jamila. But I don't know. It was supposed to be uncomfortable. Mm. Starting out in the protest, the night of the non-indictment of Darren Wilson, that was an uncomfortable moment. Can we be uncomfortable? Can we talk about race and not be politically correct? Can I question whether or not I can say Black Lives Matter? Can I question my intention of showing up out of protest shape, but still furious and still frustrated and self-conscious?
Mm-hmm.
Can I be self-conscious? Yes, that's some human shit. Like, I wanted to be human. I didn't want to be perfect.
Right.
There's no perfect version of this song.
Right. And that it seems from what you've said about the song, what your collaborators have said, you know, whether it's Jamila or Hollis, that song was heavily workshopped in a way that I imagine other songs on the record were not workshopped.
Absolutely.
in that same way.
Absolutely.
Was there ever a point in the process of that workshopping where because I imagine the conversation went in 20 different directions.
Yeah.
Right. So was there ever a point where it's like, you know what, this should be 3 minutes and 20 seconds. This should be terse. This should be to the point.
There was one person that thought that. You know, if you just got rid of this section and this section, this could be played on the radio.
Is that person sitting in this room?
No. No. I just disagreed. I disagreed.
Yeah.
Also, it's a jazz song. There's nothing like contemporary about what we made. And that was a deliberate, you know, as jazz being something that was appropriated and then eventually kind of like, at this point, has slowly diminished over time as a popular art form, unfortunately. There's irony in that as well.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I wanted to make a jazz play, not a pop song.
You must have considered, though, at the same time, that the effectiveness of making a jazz play is different than the effectiveness of making a pop song. What do you think the utility of you with your skill set and your background making a jazz play, like basically does that extend the conversation?
I said jazz play. I don't know about jazz play
is the
summary of this record. But
we're going to get all the emails from all the jazz play writers.
Yeah. What's a jazz play?
The thing is, if the song's going to be heard 100 times, 1,000 times, is it better if a song with the same message that's more condensed is heard 10 million times? or 30 million times? Because you really, from our conversation earlier in the day, I know reach is important to you.
Sure, sure, sure.
That I imagine that had to cross your mind.
Yeah, it did, but I just don't think that boiling down for me to try to boil down 500 plus years of oppression, into a pop record is the move.
So you think you couldn't have done that? You couldn't have done with this what you did with Same Love, for example?
No, I don't. I don't think that it is that it's meant to be comfortable. Mm-hmm. I don't think that it's meant to be easy. I do think that it's meant to be complicated, or that it inherently is complicated. Mm-hmm. It takes thoughtfulness and nuance that I don't think translates to pop radio or pop format in any aspect.
Tell me a little bit about some of the steps that you took to get to that place of writing that record. And by that, I mean whether it's the movement work you were doing or the courses you were taking or the studying you were undertaking. Talk me and talk the listeners through how you arrived at that. Mm-hmm. Because I think if someone approaches the song cold, they wouldn't necessarily understand why you've chosen that subject matter in that format, et cetera. Right.
Well, I think to bring it back fully, music has always been a means for me to try to figure the world out, figure mm-hmm. out my place in it. It's a spiritual tool. It's one that I hold in the highest regard, that I don't think about lightly, that I use as a means of processing. Mm-hmm. So starting from that point, post the heist, post the success, post the immense amount of praise and the immense amount of criticism, following all of that, there was a point where we stepped back and wanted to evaluate where we were at. Mm-hmm. And a big part of that initially was around cultural appropriation, realizing that cultural appropriation can only exist in a system of white supremacy. Mm-hmm. So what we did was we started having conversations. Ryan has a professor named Georgia Roberts, where he used to go to school at UW. Mm-hmm. She came into our office once a week and gave us readings, and we had conversations, and we read critiques, and we talked about them, and we studied kind of the origin. Because you can't just jump into this, whether it's fair or not, you can't engage in a conversation around our place in hip-hop unless you know the history of what we're talking about, the actual fabric, the foundation of the system in which we all operate under.
Right.
So it was extremely important to go back and do some homework. And that wasn't with the intent of writing a song. That wasn't with the intent of, like, sounding better in interviews. That was the intent of let's do some of the work.
Although I would imagine, especially around that time, I mean, whenever you were doing interviews, these things were coming up.
Right.
So, I imagine part of it is, I mean, I think part of being asked a difficult question, being on the receiving end of a difficult question, like, no one likes to be on the receiving end of difficult questions, but you want to feel, hey, I can answer that question.
Yeah, you want to feel like you can engage.
Yeah.
There's there's numerous answers to getting, as a white rapper, of getting engaged about race. Mm-hmm. A very popular one is that I don't want to be classified as a white rapper. Mm-hmm. I'm just a rapper.
Yep.
Or like race doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. Or whatever the numerous answers are that, sure, you know, you can say that, but that's just not
doesn't
true.
Doesn't discount it. In looking at white rappers' past, did you see a model of handling the situation that you felt was applicable to you?
I think that M has touched on it for sure. But, you know, inherently, like, I'm different than M.
Yep.
M came from Detroit, grew up in poverty. I grew up in Seattle, Washington, in like a middle to upper middle class home. M worked with Dr. Dre. I'm working with Ryan Lewis, who lives a couple miles away up the street, another white dude. It's just, there's a lot of differences, just foundationally, mm-hmm. Not to mention like stylistically or whatnot, but
right.
just in terms of upbringing. But I think that M definitely addressed white America, and
right.
he was talking about it. He didn't shy away from it because I think that he realized where he was benefiting from it.
Sure.
And pushed into that.
And also, I think Eminem was probably the first time a lot of rap fans, white, black, or otherwise, were put inside the head of a white rap kid.
Right.
And what that was like for a white rap kid.
Yeah, I mean, he was the first, not to discredit anybody, but he opened up the floodgates
right.
for the white rapper phenomenon that has taken place in the last 15 years.
And also, I think, opened up the phenomenon of the white rap fan. Because for so long, a white rap fan had nothing to look at that looked like them. I mean, you know, you have Vanilla Ice and people want to distance themselves from Vanilla Ice. You have Third Bass and not everybody knows about Third Bass.
Sure, sure.
But Eminem was like the white rap kid who happened to also be like a demon rapper who happened to also be working with Dr. Dre.
Right.
But that was something that didn't exist in the culture of the creators and also didn't exist in fan culture either. Let's jump back a little bit, because White Privilege 2 is a sequel.
Mm-hmm.
Let's actually listen to a little bit of White Privilege 1.0.
I see so many people lost who really try to pretend, but am I just another white boy who's caught on to the trend? When I take a step to the mic, is hip-hop closer to the end? Cause when I go to shows, the majority have white skin. They marketed the windmill, the air flare and head spin, and white rappers' albums really get the most spins. The face of hip-hop has changed a lot since Eminem, and if he's taking away black artists' profits, I look just like him. Claim the culture that wasn't mine, the way of the American. Hip-hop is gentrified, and where will all the people live? It's like the Central District, Beacon Hill to the South End, being pushed further away because of what white people did. Now, where's my place in the music?
This record is 2005, White Privilege. Tell us about Macklemore in 2005. What was the scene like in Seattle? Mm-hmm. What made you want to write that record? And what did people say to you? Looking at it now, it feels obvious and prescient. In 2005... You tell me what it looked like.
In 2005, I was in college. Had really gotten introduced to the term white privilege in college.
Mm-hmm. So it never came up in your house before? Like, it wasn't something that, like, was...
No, not that I can remember.
Mm-hmm.
I remember going to a Dead Prez show at my school.
Yeah, that'll do it.
And this is about an hour away from Seattle, where I went to school in college. And it was a completely different demographic. Then I just realized, like, okay, this is 96% white people in this room.
Mm-hmm.
When I rewind 5 years, 6 years, 7 years in my teenage years, when I first started to go to hip hop shows, like, I was, you know, one of like 15 white people, you know, even in Seattle. Eminem hadn't happened yet.
Right.
And the demographic was extremely different. And that was the tipping point for me to kind of take a step back and look at who was in the crowd, the lyrics that they were singing to in the engagement, and be like, wow, this has completely changed. And I went home that night and I wrote the first verse of White Privilege.
I'm interested in paralleling that moment at the Dead Prez concert with your moment at the protest, the night of the non-indictment of Darren Wilson. What did you see at that show? Did you look around and see, here's 96% white kids rapping along to radical black pride anthems?
Right.
Is that what you saw? And if so, did you feel like you were a part of that? Were you also rapping along? Did you hold up a mirror to yourself and say, should I be here? Should I be rapping along?
I think it was a mirror moment. It was definitely a what has happened moment. It was a moment of, let me take a step back and observe culture and the culture that has changed so drastically. Why it's happened, and that's what that song turned into, was me in, you know, it was 2004 when I started writing the record, 2005 when it got put out, but it was, let me examine my place within this art form and ask a lot of questions. It wasn't, you know, whether it's White Privilege 1 or White Privilege 2, I think a lot of people want conclusions. They want, like, okay, like, what's the answer? Like, you're not saying what the answer is. And I didn't have the answer then, and I don't have the answer now.
Mm-hmm.
But I think a huge part of it is observing, questioning, looking at how I fit in, where to go from here, and the steps to take, and having a dialogue with community around that. And I think that when I did that in 2004, that was a solo expedition. It was one that came about actually with an ex-girlfriend who was talking to me about appropriation, talking to me about white privilege. So it wasn't solo, but it wasn't the communal space that White Privilege 2 had.
Is that ex-girlfriend a white girl?
No. Kind of, no.
No?
Not fully.
An interesting thing about that moment is, this is around the time you're starting to get buzzed in the Seattle hip-hop scene.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is sort of the early window. I think it's important because this scene has a little bit been lost to memory, but, like, let's talk about the independent rap backpack, post-backpack scene mm-hmm. of the mid-2000s. Mm-hmm. You know, you're the Scribble Jams of the world. Mm-hmm. You're Rhyme Sayers of the world. You're Def Jux of the mm-hmm. world. That was the first time that I remember very vividly going to shows where I was like, it's white guys on stage, white rappers, white producers, white DJs, yeah. rapping about, I mean, who knows, white stuff, whatever, you know, and basically everyone in the room is white.
Yeah.
And that was something that was very, very unusual for me.
Yeah.
And as a critic and as a writer, I was struggling with it. I remember at the time, like, I wrote a thing for Spin, I want to say in like 03 or 04, mm-hmm. and I was like, emo rap, that's what this is.
Yeah.
You know, it's like you, there was this urge to be like, well, something, we got to explain this thing, because what the hell is going on here? Mm-hmm. So that was like my way of processing, and then you making this song was your way of processing it.
Yeah.
But you being in that scene, mm-hmm. how did people respond to you? One thing that I always remember is when I would ask people about it, mm-hmm. they was kind of like, nah, man, I just spit. You know,
yeah.
you know, like no one really wanted to get into it.
No, it's easier as a white dude to ignore it.
Yeah.
It's absolutely easier. If I'm looking back at it, it started out uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And again, I'm not bringing a bunch of Grammys and accolades and platinum plaques with me in 2004 to the conversation. I'm at this point, no one knows who I am for the most part. And I think that it was interesting in the small, like, microcosm of Seattle. I would say at the beginning, it was a song that was appreciated for the most part by people of color
mm-hmm.
that I was touching on the subject.
Mm-hmm.
That at the beginning, white people didn't know how to react to it. And then, again, this is all microcosm, and this is me like 11, 12 years ago, I guess 10 years ago. Once I kind of gained some popularity and kids in the audience were singing along to the words, that flipped, like white kids in the audience were singing along mm-hmm. to the words,
mm-hmm.
that perspective flipped a little bit. And I think that, you know, within the hip-hop community, the people of color that were at those shows or were, you know, my friends were like, this is a little bit weird now.
Mm-hmm.
They're, like, singing along to this song about, like,
still own
40 acres. Now we still own their 16 bars. And they're rapping along with you like, this is weird.
Did you have conversations with folks or was it more of a vibe you were getting?
No, I had conversations for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Were they saying maybe you shouldn't perform this song? Were people coming to you and saying, this felt like a positive step that now has sort of like gone in the wrong direction and maybe everybody needs to back off it kind
of? Yeah, no, I don't think, I don't remember it ever turning into like, don't perform this or you shouldn't perform this.
Mm-hmm.
I do remember conversations and I do remember from what was like, yo, good work, turned into like, this is it's a little weird, dude.
But this is also, I mean, just sort of like step out a little bit more broadly, like this is the paradox of like the white liberal. Ultimately, because you as a performer and a thinker, and then by extension, your fans who are taking your music in, everybody wants to show that they are forward thinking and progressive and anti-racist right. and so on and so forth.
Sure.
And yet there's a certain safety, because if you're doing that within the framework of white privilege, are you really doing work at all?
Mm-hmm.
Is it enough work to just say, I get it?
No.
But that's, I think that's maybe that reaction that you were getting is kind of like, people from the outside looking and being like, well, just because your fans are rapping that, like, is
and
that
I think
really
that,
enough?
And I think that whether or not that was broken down a decade ago or not, maybe it was, but I can say that it's not enough.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that in a lot of ways, it wasn't the intention of writing the song, but I think that if I was to critique myself 10 years ago,
right.
it would be that there wasn't any real follow-up. Mm-hmm. outside of the record.
Right.
And it wasn't like, hey guys, like I addressed it, like I got white privilege, like peace, I'm out. Like
mm-hmm.
but that's kind of what it turned into a little bit.
Because, and this is something we talked about earlier in the day as well, those rooms in particular started to feel not transgressive. Like they started to feel like safe spaces. They started mm-hmm. to feel like safe white liberal spaces.
Yeah.
Even like a Necro show or something weirdly felt like a safe white space.
Mm.
You know, anything from a Necro to Idea to Aesop Rock or whatever, like each in their own individual way, the dynamic loop between performer and audience felt very closed and mm-hmm. very samey.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't much challenge.
Mm-hmm.
And like, I felt like people were, it was like attracting like. It had like a magnetic quality.
Well, yeah. And there was also like, and I've obviously experienced this on a mass scale now, but there was oftentimes a sentiment of like, this is what real hip hop is.
Yes.
This is, you know, this conscious shit, like this is where it's at. What Rhymesayers is doing, that's real hip hop. Like what Def Jux is doing, that's real hip hop. This is the fucking textbook definition of real hip hop.
Look at Def Jux, and you take Def Jux back to the Raucous era and to Company Flow. Company Flow comes out in 96, 97. This is like peak Bad Boy era, just after Dr. Dre.
Right, right.
And so if you're the type of rap purist who basically thinks that like
you're the shiny suit is whack.
Exactly. Like you're like, I only like Mobb Deep and Nori and CNN. Yeah. I don't like Puff and Mace.
Yeah.
Weirdly, the values of like the Company Flow and Raucous systems speak to you in a way where there was a strange overlap between like the OG backpack kids who were like into Boot Camp Click.
Right.
And the kind of like 2.0 backpack kids who were like college kids wearing backpacks.
Era that, that transformed the Def Jux and Rhymesayers.
Exactly. And yes, that purism strain ran through to the point where you would be at shows where it's completely white and be like, people would be like, this is the real stuff.
Yeah.
You'd be like, what?
Yeah.
This?
Mm-hmm.
And it was a very, very strange time. And there was a moment where I think that generation of white fans felt that they were protecting the art form.
Yeah.
Which was like a very,
I know,
very dark moment.
I did. I was a teenager and was like, this is what it is.
Right.
Like, this is the culture. You know, using words like culture and art form and like, you know, a bunch of spiritual lyricals in there too.
Yeah, of course.
There was that feeling. For my personal taste, it was much more freestyle fellowship and hieroglyphics and living legends.
Well, you're on the West Coast.
I was on the West Coast.
Sure.
But it still was the same sentiment. And it was still, you know, although it might not have been like all white people because the people on stage were people of color, but the crowd was certainly much more that.
And also, I think you were in college, which years? Early 2000s?
2002, yeah. 3, yeah.
I mean, by that time, like, hip-hop was, like, a fully collegiate, you know, like, you think of, like, the college tour circuit and, you know, people booking spring fling shows and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
That stuff, I would say, by, like, 97, 98, 99 was, like, much more firmly ensconced.
Yeah.
It was, like, basically, like, the way that, like, teen pop dudes had to do mall tours, like, conscious rap groups had to do, like, the spring flings tours.
Right, right.
So by the time you were in college, that was, like, in full. Like, I remember my junior year, maybe, like, Farside came, and it was like, oh, my God, like, Farside, oh, this is the realest thing ever.
Yeah.
And then I remember going back 3 or 4 years later, and it was, like, everything was like, it wasn't just like we have one rap group. It was like the whole thing was hip hop, which was like unthinkable in 1995 or 1996 where I was. The collegiate audience took over, and with it took over a sort of collegiate sensibility and a collegiate sense of politics.
Mm-hmm.
That's really the moment where the sort of white backpack underground really, I think, calcifies and is like, we do this.
Yeah.
This is us, and we're saving hip hop.
Yeah.
There's just nothing weirder than being in a room of white people swearing that they're saving hip hop.
Yeah,
how did you get away from that? Because I've got to assume at some point, like, not only did you see its toxicity, obviously you didn't make 12 songs about white privilege. Like, you made your song, you made your point, and then you continued on with your career.
Sure.
What pushed you to get away from it, or how did you choose to get away from it? Or did you not get away from it? Because that scene, that scene's vital right now, if we're being honest. Like, you know, we could go all love to those crews and to those labels, but like, Rhymesayers has a huge festival every single summer, and I imagine it's pretty heavily white. That'd be my guess.
Yeah.
Slug, if you want to call me and tell me it's not, like,
no,
that's cool.
I think that that's accurate.
I'll eat it. I'll eat that if I'm wrong.
You know, what kind of happened was a lot of years went by, and I, you know, in the midst of struggling with addiction and stagnation and escapism, along with just, like, it never really popped off. It wasn't like I put out the album in 2005. You know, it probably my peak. I could do like maybe 300 or 400 people at a venue in Seattle. Mm-hmm. Had a little bit of a fan base in Portland. Like maybe 75 people came to a show in Vancouver, BC. But it never popped. So it wasn't something that I had to escape. I never really garnered that fan base at the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, fast forward up until 2009, 2010, that's when I started to work with Ryan, and mm-hmm. we started to get more of a fan base where there was more crossover into that Rhymesayers, whatever, underground, white, backpack rap type mm-hmm. fan base that, you know, to be completely honest, I didn't feel a part of. I didn't feel a part of in terms of, like, the content that I was writing about. Mm-hmm. And I didn't feel a part of it because I was never really in that scene fully. I respected it. Mm-hmm. I still respect it. I think that what those guys have done at Rhymesayers is amazing mm-hmm. In terms of a label and in terms of creating a scene and in a lot of ways a platform for me to operate in those initial years mm-hmm. and the engagement with fans and how they ran their business mm-hmm. Was definitely inspiring. But in terms of the actual music, as much as I respected it, that wasn't what I was drawing my influence from. We also, I think, had a different core demographic as well.
Well, yeah, I mean, Rhymesayers, obviously, you know, Slug is a Lothario, and Slug is rapping about his feelings constantly, and, you know, Idea was sort of a battle rapper, rest in peace, Idea. I always felt like the values of Rhymesayers, and, you know, then you had Brother Ali. It's like the values of Rhymesayers always felt very specific to mm. Rhymesayers, and it was, like, hard to replicate. You couldn't, like, go to Kansas City and be like, make me a Rhymesayers. Right. It just wouldn't work.
Right.
Because each of those people were so specific and mm-hmm. almost idiosyncratic in a weird way. Mm-hmm. But they had basically established the template for what could be a national scene slash idea about hip hop,
right?
And of independent hip hop,
right?
So I imagine it gave you, like you say, it gave you a structure and it gave you a framework.
Absolutely, and there was definitely comparisons too. Like people were like, "Yo, you sound like Slug. You sound like Brother Ali. You're emotional too. You know, you have heavy songs. Like, you guys are what real hip hop looks like." And all these things that I definitely heard, mm-hmm. but I wasn't quite big enough to like have to escape that, really.
Right, because it's like a small echo chamber, basically.
Well, also, like, those guys were, like, the biggest of that. There wasn't, you know, an in-between between, like, Slug and Eminem.
Right.
There wasn't. That hadn't existed yet.
Right.
And probably not until, like, Mac Miller did that.
I was just going to say Mac Miller.
Yeah, Mac Miller was kind of the bridge between, like, a pop audience, yet someone with some, like, old backpacker values, but, like, not super mainstream on the radio yet, but still, like, came out and sold 150,000
right.
first week.
And also, like, did a record with Ariana Grande and has mm-hmm. an MTV show and kind of, like,
right.
it
right.
has, like, a little charisma to him.
Right.
But he's not, like, trying to sell you on, like, I'm the most poppy, mainstream, down-the-center guy.
Right.
Let's jump up to the making of records for The Heist. Mm-hmm. A thing that I think I remember being really struck by, and I think you probably got some flack for at the time, was if you look at Same Love and you look at Thrift Shop as values, yeah. The values of those songs, those are values that are not always represented in the mainstream of hip-hop. Mm. There were critiques where you, as a white rapper, are rapping about subjects that, you know, if there's such a thing as white subject matter, it's white subject matter, mm-hmm. For a predominantly white audience. Mm-hmm. When you were receiving that, how did that make you feel? When you were making those records, did you understand yourself as writing something outside of the center of hip-hop?
Yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't, at the time, like, as racially scrutinized.
Right.
I wasn't like, oh, like...
Well, you're doing it in relative anonymity when you were writing the records,
exactly,
I assume.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. That critique also happened not when those songs were released, not when the album was being reviewed from the jump. That critique came quite a bit later when those songs became commercially successful.
Right.
So when Same Love came out, it wasn't this like, oh God, like, you know, here's this white guy like talking about gay marriage. Mm-hmm. Like it was real. It was a real moment. It simultaneously linked up with Referendum 74 in Seattle mm-hmm. and the passing of legalizing gay marriage that following fall. And it was very much a moment that wasn't calculated, that wasn't planned, that mm-hmm. wasn't critiqued really until you fast forward like 9 months later to a year later. That's when the critique happened, when it became successful.
Were you surprised that that critique came?
No. And that's not to discard the critique. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, it didn't happen in the beginning. Like, you
no,
know,
I get
it's
it.
All good. It's more just to look back at that time.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you had just way more eyeballs on you. And also, look, by the time Thrift Shop became what it became, you were being looked at in an entirely different way. People had to pay attention who didn't have to pay attention previously. Right. So you're inviting an entire set of new eyes to
absolutely.
The party.
I mean, I remember you wrote a critique on Thrift Shop.
Very true.
And, you know, had it not turned into
a thing, right.
You would have never had the lens of writing about it in the first place.
Right.
Or could have felt completely differently about it.
I remember at that time thinking, like watching how the song was going and be like, at some point, if this passes a threshold,
yeah.
I'm going to have to say something.
I have to speak on it.
Right. If it doesn't pass a threshold, I mean, there are zillions of things
right,
that don't
let it go.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, and this is one of the sort of challenges of criticism. It's like, it's as much about what you don't write as what you do write. You got to, mm-hmm. you kind of got to pick your shots a little bit. And I remember thinking, like, if this is like literally just a blip, okay, it's
let
a,
it
blip.
Be a blip.
Yeah.
yeah.
But if this turned into OMG.
Yeah.
And then it turned into OMG, and I was just like, we got
to
go.
And I think so much of that comes down to who's resonating with the song,
mm-hmm.
who's supporting it, who are the people that are, you know, buying this single, who mm-hmm. are the people that are dressing up in fur coats and going out and, on Halloween, who
right.
are the people that are showing up to the shows. How does this relate to other aspects of pop culture right now? How does this fit into the greater mechanism? And let's dissect that, not necessarily the art from the jump.
Right.
And that was kind of the interesting, like, evolution of criticism that came from the art that we were making, as it seemed like it was much more a reaction to
The success
than it was.
Oh, I think that's definitely the case.
But again, that's not to discredit
mm-hmm.
the criticism.
When you listen now to Thrift Shop, I mean, I don't know if you like bump it in the car or not, but when you listen back
couple times a day.
Yeah, as you, you just when you were walking in,
right.
you started playing. Yeah. When you listen to Thrift Shop today, does it feel tisk-tisky to you? When you listen to Same Love today, does it feel tisk-tisky to you?
No, it doesn't. I understand those takeaways.
Yeah.
You know, I think that the most controversial line in Same Love, I mean, there's depending on who you're talking to.
Right.
Because there's definitely some religious controversial lines. But mm-hmm. in terms of what we're talking about, there's the, if I was gay, I would think hip-hop hates me.
Right.
Have you read the YouTube comments lately?
Mm-hmm.
And what I was talking about was comments and not like hip hop as a genre or a culture.
Or
it was more like the comment section on YouTube videos, internet culture
mm-hmm.
that is commenting on hip hop.
Right.
Not people of color, not the culture, but internet culture. That was the most direct way of saying that. If you say like, if I was gay, I would think internet culture hates me. It doesn't quite have the same ring to it.
Right. Although it's true.
Although it's true. It's yeah, absolutely yeah. true. And not to say that that line was, you know, going for some shock value. It was just a matter of a figure of speech
mm-hmm.
that I think, again, later on ended up getting criticized,
mm-hmm.
Which I understand that critique.
Right. Sometimes I think from the outside looking in, it's unclear what's worse, like, participating in the culture as you do and not kind of understanding the big problems, or participating in the culture and you do and totally understanding it,
yeah.
but still basically being the guy who participates.
Yeah, still it's, doing it.
Yeah. So that's a bind, obviously.
Yeah.
That's not going to change, and that's not going to change as long as you're making art of this nature. It's just not going to change.
Mm-hmm.
When I was looking at Thrift Shop especially and seeing – and then later, many months later, went to your show and seeing the audience, when you look out at that crowd and you see – 98% white faces. What does that make you feel? Because I imagine it makes Dead Prez feel one kind of thing, and maybe I'll get M1 up here and like we can have that conversation. But what does it make you feel? Especially as someone who I assume when you started out didn't necessarily envision a career
no.
rapping for 14-year-old white girls.
Yeah. For one, our demographic on this last tour has completely changed.
Is that right?
See,
because you've just been on the road for what, 4 weeks now?
Yeah, for 4 weeks.
Okay.
And way older.
Really?
I don't really get it.
See, it's radical enough that you catch.
Completely changed.
Okay.
Not to say that, like, there's not teenagers in the crowd.
Sure.
By any means, but it used to
but
be like that was the...
Right, like when I went to your show at the Garden
right.
Side Theater, it was just like...
I just call it the Garden.
Yeah.
At the Garden.
Absolutely. The Gardenia.
The Gardenia.
Yes, at the Gardenia. When I was at the Gardenia, it was like being at a Jonas Brothers concert almost.
Yeah.
Even I wasn't prepared for that. Like, I was kind of like, oh, it's going to be a lot of young white kids, but I was stupefied.
Right. I mean, I think that a huge factor in that is the radio.
Yeah.
And I think we haven't been on the radio in a while.
So it sort of filters out, in a weird way, a certain fan base.
I think so.
Ah, that's interesting.
Yeah, I'm not 100% on that, but that would be my initial take on it. And, you know, we've also been touring, like, kind of different markets in the last month and doing a theater tour. And it's billed as an evening with Macklemore and Ryan Lewis. And the album was supposed to have come out. It didn't come out. So who knows what the equation is that it's equating to older folks in the audience, but and more diverse than it was in the past, but, you know, still absolutely the majority white.
Mm-hmm.
What's my feeling? You don't pick your fan base.
Of course.
There's not this feeling of like, damn, man, like I really wish it was more diverse. I mean, maybe there is. Diversity is a beautiful thing. I think that if all people, you know, it's a loaded question because it goes much deeper than just music.
Sure.
But I think that ideally all people resonate with the art that you make, and that is embodied in the sea of people in the crowd. When it's not that, I think that I can understand why it is.
Do you think seeing those crowds, not on this most recent tour, but on like the Gardenia tour and whatnot, seeing those crowds, was that part of the reason that you felt the onus of responsibility to do a record like White Privilege 2? Now, because you knew who was listening or who could be listening?
I think that's part of it, for sure.
A thing I was struck by in the interview, I think that Jamila did, maybe it was with Jezebel, or you guys did an interview together also, the NPR thing. Mm-hmm. It was one of the two. And she said that for the first time, she had to be very conscious of writing for a white audience,
right,
which I thought was very striking. Because I feel like you very rarely hear artists of any kind, certainly black artists, say, I have to write for a white audience.
Yeah.
That's just not something that comes up a lot.
She said, your silence is a luxury.
Yeah. She said it very loudly.
She wasn't talking to black folks. She was talking to white folks.
Tell me about the decision, because like that song, like you said, was very workshopped.
Mm-hmm.
Who's the listener? Who's the intended listener of that song? Who's the goal listener?
The goal intended audience in that is white people.
And I don't mean this in a pain in the butt way, but like which white people?
To me, it starts with youth. Mm-hmm. If we're actually going to undo institutionalized racism, it's not going to happen in my lifetime, I would probably imagine. It's going to be a long lineage of teaching the truth about racism, teaching where it comes from, how it has existed, how it benefits people with white skin, and starting from an early age. So whereas I learned about white privilege on a very surface level at, you know, 19 or 20, I know that I have 7, 8, 9 year olds that know Downtown or that know Thrift Shop. I know that I have a teenage fan base from 13, 14, 15 up that is listening to my music.
Mm-hmm.
So if they're hearing terms like white supremacy, if they're hearing terms like privilege and cultural appropriation 5, 6, 7 years before I did in college, and I start having conversations about it then, I think that's a beautiful thing.
Mm-hmm.
So that was, I think, at the core, the intended audience.
The mission.
Of course, it's broader than that. It's not just like, that's it.
Sure.
Just put a box on the teenagers. But I think that there's a teenage and college white kids. If I can create a conversation and in a workshop way that people are having dialogue, that's a good thing for the world.
I sort of see it as like, there's three potential, I mean, there's a zillion potential audiences. There's three potential audiences. There's the young and impressionable, which is who you're talking about. There are the self-regarding liberals who are like, yeah, I get it. I'm into it. Like, what he's talking about is basically what I already know, or like a version of it, or like I'm adjacent to it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was actually very intrigued by a third audience, which are people who fundamentally reject the concept of white supremacy.
Yeah.
Have you had any opportunity to, like, engage with people who are very firmly on the right wing, who, I mean, can you get this played at a Republican presidential debate? You know, no, like this is because I'm all for being impressionable with the youth because ultimately, but I feel like society's moving in that direction generally.
Sure.
I like to think it's moving in that direction of more tolerance and more understanding regardless. Not everything in recent history bears that out, but one can hope.
Right.
But then when you look at the sort of like the level of discourse and vitriol that's coming from the political right wing and from parts of American culture that are anti-Muslim, anti-immigrant, racist, you know, your all lives matter as opposed to your black lives matter.
Right.
I wonder if the song is maybe a tool in that conversation.
I would hope that it is. You know, I think that one of the voices after I finished my my last verse. His name's Jonathan Cunningham.
Oh, Words There?
No. Oh. No, that's Jonathan Moore.
Oh, right.
But I like that you know Words There.
Of course.
Jonathan Cunningham, he's a writer, and he works with youth in Seattle. Sure.
Okay, yeah. I think we're Facebook friends.
Yeah. He breaks down Black Lives Matter and does so in an anecdotal way or a visual way where he's talking about if one housing unit is on fire, you're not going to spray the entire block.
Right.
And I think that that alone—
Very vivid memory.
Has connected with white people who might have been like, wait, but all lives matter. Like, why— All of a sudden, that switch, all it takes is that switch for it to be phrased in a way that mainstream media possibly isn't going to do, or like this person isn't going to read, this think piece or that think piece, that they're not reading the New York Times. They're just listening to some hip hop music, and they might come from a household or a neighborhood or a community where all lives matter, and that's the general consensus amongst their white peers.
Right.
Where all of a sudden that switch might be flipped, and they start having conversations, and the dialogue changes within that community. And I think that kind of sounds like this like utopia of a place, but I think that that's how change happens. And I think we discard that because we're in this society where it's like, we want answers. We want answers quick. We want quick fixes to all this shit. Like, for white people, like, I get it. I'm woke. I have white privilege. Like, Macklemore is just telling me shit that like I could have heard in high school. Mm-hmm. Like, I didn't hear it in high school.
Sure.
I don't know what high school you went to.
Right.
I didn't hear it in high school, and I barely heard it in college. So let's engage the youth. Let's have conversations. If it's coming from a place of changing one person's mind, then that has the potential to spread. Mm-hmm. And again, I don't think that that's some utopia shit. I think that that's how change happens.
And also the thing that we talked about earlier about white liberal safe spaces, whether it's a backpack rap concert in 2005 or a bunch of media people having a drink in 2016.
Right.
Who all like, yeah, I get it.
Well, yeah, like, I get it.
Like, you pass. Know, like, I get it. Pass.
Yeah, I get it. Pass. Like, this isn't for me. At best, maybe this is for like some people that don't get it, but like, I'll never listen to this again.
Right.
And what the point of this is to have the conversation, not just like once, but to continue the conversation, to continue to go into those uncomfortable places,
right,
to show up. And I don't think that that's on Facebook.
No, and also I think it's important, like, a lot of times, like, the people who do what I do, there's not a lot of self-interrogation. You know what I mean? Like, the people who are, I mean, there's any number of white people who write about rap music, et cetera,
right,
et cetera. There's not a lot of self-interrogation. There's a lot of assumption. It's like, well, if I like Prodigy, or if I like Jadakiss, or if I like Fetty Wap, then I'll just do this and it's okay.
Right.
And that's not to say you can't have a valid opinion on any of those things, but as far as like robust, rigid, thoughtful criticism, in my world, tends to come from the people who have engaged with these questions and try to like identify the core problems of your own participation. In the same way that you question yours, I question mine. Like, that's, it's what we do.
Exactly. And I think that there's not a publication or a blog that critiques critics, you know what I'm saying?
Sure.
Like, that's an
interesting— it's called Twitter.
It's called Twitter. But for the most part, like, you guys get the pass.
Mm-hmm.
And it is an interesting phenomenon of, like, a bunch of, like, middle-aged white dudes or females critiquing hip-hop music.
Mm-hmm.
Again, not to say that that space shouldn't exist, but it's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting how— people become the specialists on a culture that they have never participated in outside of from afar and looking through a lens of whiteness.
Right. Well, the gate, because, whiteness reinforces whiteness. Gatekeeper culture keeps certain voices on the outside.
Right.
And, I remember when I started writing for more mainstream publications, like I wrote for hip hop publications first and then wrote for more mainstream publications. A lot of my motivation at the time was the people who were covering rap music for a lot of those mainstream places. I was like, you're not at the concerts. You're not at the, like, I don't,
right.
It seems bizarre to me that this is the authoritative voice in this, a publication, whatever it may be, but like it has some authority. It has a reputation. And it just seems so baffling that like, yeah, okay, I kind of trust your rock guy. I kind of trust your pop guy.
Yeah.
But I have no idea what's going on with hip hop coverage. Mm-hmm. And I think that's it's different now. And it was different. It changed a lot in the 2000s. I think like the doors opened a little bit more. And now with the internet, I just feel like it's amplifying a whole bunch of different voices, whether it's penetrating institutions. Sometimes yes, sometimes no. But that's something that I feel like you're trying to take seriously in your engagement. And I feel like in my world, if I'm not taking seriously, I'm doing a bad job.
Yeah.
And so that's a struggle. Do you feel that being a white rapper is almost by definition political?
No, I don't. Mm-hmm. I think that there are numerous examples of white rappers that don't want to talk about politics, that don't talk about politics, that don't want to bring up their whiteness in interviews, that negate the topic. And I think that there's some that press into it. I think that just like any artist, there's going to be some people that step into that space and some people that avoid it and some people that are just impartial.
Whether or not they want to participate in it or not, but do you feel like the act itself has a political... Because like obviously you mentioned Iggy and Miley and whatever, which I understand you're using them almost as a metaphorical stand-in in the song. But also you look at what Iggy's doing. Iggy's not rapping about whiteness. Iggy's not rapping about anxiety about participation in hip hop culture. Yeah. But is there not something almost political in her rejection of that? Maybe not politics that you agree with, but the approach, or is it just simply that's like white power and white supremacy in action and then like boom, that's what it is?
I don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I don't know how to answer that. Mm-hmm.
Do you feel that you could be a white rapper who's not a political rapper?
I think I could.
Mm-hmm. You are on this album in places.
Yeah. Like, I don't think that, like, because I'm a white rapper, it's not like, okay, like, now I need to step into this space and occupy all of this space. Mm-hmm. Like, let me just talk about race. I want to be able to talk about a multitude of different things, and different songs call for different intentions.
I'll repeat something that we talked about earlier today, mm-hmm. just because I think it bears repeating in this particular format, which sure. is like, I'd like to see as many think pieces about Spoons
right.
as about white privilege too.
Right.
Spoons is a song on the record about cuddling, basically.
Spooning.
Yeah. And that's just not subject matter you get a lot of, mm-hmm. really, like outside of like a Jason Mraz record maybe or something. But
Jason hasn't touched on that.
That's right. Yeah, he's scared.
Yeah,
Jason, why are you scared of talking about spooning? Why are you scared? But when I think about that and your role as a white rapper and the politics of being a white rapper, it also speaks to the fact that you can rap about a range of subjects
right.
that maybe other rappers can't speak about or are discouraged from speaking about.
Absolutely.
Do you think about that and do you problematize that?
I'm aware of it. I think about it. I don't ever want to create from a space of like, oh, like, you know, because I'm safe to this audience, to this white demographic, like, that means I can rap about spoons and be fine.
Mm-hmm.
I shouldn't do it. As long as there is a balance throughout an album of who I generally am, I feel good about myself mm-hmm. as a whole. If I'm just cutting off slivers of who I am to try to pertain to a certain demographic or to gain acceptance within the hip hop community or just to make pop records or whatever, that isn't authentic to who I am.
Have you considered getting Kodak Black on a remix of Spoons?
It's the process is happening.
It's happening. Okay. I just want to put that out there. Okay. So I'd like to close out with, in essence, white rap speed round. I want to talk not necessarily whether you like them or not, but sort of what they evoke for you.
Oh, God. Okay.
Aesop Rock.
I'm not too familiar with his body of work. Mm-hmm.
You mentioned him in a song.
Yeah. He was super poppin'.
Shouts to Labor Days.
Yeah, I was never like a huge fan. He used words I didn't understand.
Me too.
But he can definitely rap,
mm-hmm.
for sure, and crazy vocabulary.
Dose One?
can't say I'm too well-versed in Dose. I just remember, like, knowing of who he was mm-hmm. back in the day. He had a really, like, nasally voice.
Yes.
Like,
yes.
I don't know if I understood it back then.
It was hard. I mean, shouts to Anacon and Deep Puddle Dynamics as well. All right, Kid Rock. OG Kid Rock, 1.0 Kid Rock, not 2.0 Kid Rock or 6.0 Kid Rock.
Kid Rock, I don't really know.
Did you ever listen to the real rap, like his rap
no.
records? Never.
Uh-huh. I don't know how much I'm gonna be well versed in this.
I feel like I'm gonna have to make you like a Spotify playlist.
You gotta make me a mixtape.
Oh my lord, Insane Clown Posse.
Do they have the song Miracles?
Yeah, yes, that's the one. Is that the one with the magnets? How do they work?
Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah, that's fine. That's fine.
That's the only thing I know, but that bar is fire.
Ari the Rugged Man.
Not too well versed.
I feel like I'm gonna have to take your backpack back after this particular conversation.
Yeah, I know.
Bubba Sparks?
Bubba. Yeah, I remember when Bubba came out, he had Timberland beats. Like, yeah. Those beats were really dope. He could definitely rap. I don't know the body of work.
My gosh. I'm definitely gonna make you a Spotify list. Milkbone.
Not familiar.
How old are you?
I'm 32, but I don't know. I know Milkbone. I know of Milkbone, yeah. But I couldn't tell you a song.
Hooligans? Alchemist and Scott
Conn? Yeah. Never heard a record. I just know Alchemist was in it.
The last one I don't think you're going to know, but it's worth asking. Chili T?
No.
You know who that is? That's Phil Knight's son.
What?
Phil Knight from Nike.
He raps.
Yeah, he got Bomb Squad beats on that record.
Wow.
Yeah, this is like from, I want to say 90 maybe?
He's probably like 40 now or something.
Yeah, I think he's, I don't think he's, I don't think he's rapping anymore. But but that's a special moment. And, well, I figured since you have a good relationship with the world of Nike, I thought maybe, I don't know, maybe you got an honorary Chili T record as like part of the deal.
I need the t-shirt.
Next time you have a Jordan situation, you got to make sure that you get the Chili T,
right.
The bonus crap. All right, thanks for putting up with White Rap Speedrun. I appreciate that.
I like that, yeah.
Thank you for coming and talking to us
today. Thank
you, man. I appreciate it. Tell everybody about the album. It's in stores. This unruly mess I've made.
Yes. Thank you, man. Appreciate it.
And now let's go out with a little bit of Downtown, Macklemore, Ryan Lewis, Grandmaster Caz, Kool Moe Dee, Melly Mel.
Banana seat, I can't be on two wheels. 800 cash, that's a hell of a deal. I'm headed
downtown. Cruising through the alley. Tiptoeing in the street like ballet. Pulled up. Moped to the valet, white walls on the wheels like mayonnaise. Dope, my crew is ill, and all we need is two good wheels. Got gas in the tank, cash in the bank, and a bad little mama with dirt on my face. I'ma lick that, stick that, break her off, kick gas, snuck her in backstage. You don't need a wristband. Dope.
Killing the game, about to catch a body. Past the heartbeat, Dookie on the Ducati. Timberland.
Thank you again for listening to the New York Times podcast. Thank you to Macklemore for being here. You can listen to the podcast on iTunes, on Stitcher, on Audio Boom. Subscribe to us. Check out our Spotify playlist. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez. You can read my interview with Macklemore and Ryan Lewis at nytimes.com/music or in this Sunday's Arts and Leisure section. Check back with us next week.